everyone, and welcome to Margaret Beaufort, episode 17, Mother-in-Law. On the 18th of January 1486, the equation of dynasty was completed. Lancaster plus York equals Tudor. Elizabeth of York and Henry Tudor were joined in holy matrimony, and therefore brought to a close the antagonism, and everyone lived happily ever after. Well, not exactly, but it was a start. Henry had really fallen on his feet in his bride. I mean, it's always difficult to be sure at such a distance, and the sources aren't exactly as you'd like. No one found Elizabeth's Dear Diary entries for 1486, for example. But by your actions ye shall be known, or whatever it is. And Elizabeth showed herself generous to her sisters, for example, fulfilled all the roles with grace associated with queenship. She was traditionally and more than adequately pious. And although the evidence of a political role is a bit limited, there are some examples. It was Elizabeth to whom a Welsh tenant appealed over an injustice involving Jasper Tudor, for example. And Elizabeth responded with a firm letter to Jasper, which, given the regard in which he must have been held by Henry, shows some confidence by Elizabeth in her own position. Henry's accounts show frequent gifts to his wife. There's no suggestion of any mistresses on Henry's part, which wouldn't have been unusual at all for royalty of the time. Overall, from all we can see, it appears as though the relationship between Elizabeth and Henry was one of genuine affection. I say all this as a precursor to the critical debate which we must follow, of course. Was Margaret Beaufort, I ask you, the mother-in-law from hell, or was she not? That is the question we must answer. What is very clear is that Margaret was very active indeed at court from the very beginning. And just to re-emphasise the point, she had a super close relationship with her son and would retain influence consistently throughout their lives. Let me quote you a few lines from Henry from a rare surviving letter, though you do need to bear in mind that flowery was definitely a la mode at the time. "I shall be as glad to please you as your heart can desire it, and I know full well that I am as much bounden to do as any creature living for the great and singular motherly love and affection that it hath pleased you at all times to bear towards me." Lord knows what my mother's reaction would be to such a letter from me. So, Henry felt an obligation towards Margaret. He trusted her advice. He respected her judgment. Contemporaries noted that the sense of obligation was a lever that the quick-witted could lean on. Or, so more than one request for favours to Henry included a reference to previous aid given to his mother, knowing that Henry saw this as an obligation to be honoured. John Hussey, for example, related that, "I came first to my lady your mother's service, which was in the second year of your most noble reign." There's a practical side to this too. Knowing the quality of his mother's household, previous service there was a strong recommendation, and Henry was not averse to a bit of headhunting, such as William Bolton, employed by Henry VII to create the rather lovely oriel window at St Bartholomew's in London. He had previously worked for Henry's mother on her house at Cold Harbour. Henry showered goodies on his mother, as we've seen, in the form of grants of land and wardships and favours such as making her a fam soul, no doubt at her request. He would constantly emphasise her status. This might be obliquely and favour his position too, such as the active rehabilitation of the Beaufort name, emphasising both of their legitimacy and adopting their portcullis symbol, amongst other things. In 1488, she was invested with the livery of the Order of the Garter. This was unusual for a woman, though not extraordinarily so, but Henry discontinued the practice, emphasising the status conferred on his mother thereafter, and the practice was not revived for women until 1901. Margaret kept Henry close, and unusually so. Contemporaries have remarked on the frequency with which Margaret accompanied the King and Queen on their royal progresses, for example. In 1492, the royal party with Margaret went to view the work on St George's Chapel in Windsor. 4 years later, the royal party toured Margaret's estate in the southwest. In 1498, the itineraries of both Margaret and her son survive, and good golly, they were together a lot. In July, they were together at London, Westminster, Sheen and Windsor. In August, they went for a tour of the eastern counties. Ended up in September at Margaret's palace at Colley Weston in the Midlands. And indeed, when later, after 1499, Margaret withdrew to Colley Weston to operate what was effectively her own court, she made sure that not only were a suite of rooms maintained for the Queen, but that the deer park was maintained so that her son could come and enjoy the hunting as he pleased. She informed her keeper of the park that the said deer and game to be reserved and kept for the King's pleasure and ours against such season as we shall repair unto these parts. Her house was always to be immediately available for the son's pleasure. The favour was lovingly returned. A suite of rooms was maintained for Margaret's use in all the royal palaces. And not just any old rooms, sort of close to the loo, that sort of thing. They were rooms close to the king so that his ear was always available. And, it must be said, her advice was always available. Again, advice that he knew would be designed to further his best interests. So at Woodstock, the king and mother's chambers were linked by a withdrawing chamber. That belongs to the king's chamber and my and his mother's. So on the mother-in-law question, one thing is clear. Elizabeth would certainly have seen plenty of her mother-in-law. Nor was Margaret in any way a cipher at court, ornamental, the old trout parked in the corner and kept quiet. No, indeed, she was instead at the centre of both court life and cultivated a semi-regal aura and precedence in procedures and ceremonies to match. Elizabeth had been finally crowned in 1487. Henry had been careful to leave her coronation to be well after and separate to his, just so that everyone knew that it was quite clear that his legitimacy did not rest on his marriage, all right? Margaret was a very visible and regal presence at the event. The Queen kept her estate in the Parliament chamber, and my lady, the Queen's mother, sat on her right-hand side. The daughter, born to the royal couple in 1489, was named after Margaret. At the Christmas court of 1487, Margaret was observed wearing like mantle and surcoat as the Queen, with a rich coronal on her head. Now, I suppose this could have been done in agreement, but it looks rather as though Margaret was making a point about her status, and it's quite clear that Margaret was in no way shy about how high that status was. In 1498, for example, Margaret changed her signature to Margaret R from Margaret of Richmond. Now, did she mean Margaret Regina, Queen Margaret? It would seem she was not prepared to go quite that far, obviously, but it seemed very likely that by using Margaret R, Margaret was perfectly happy for people to take the hint and make a mistake and get it wrong. While Margaret's portraits emphasise austerity and piety, without doubt they would have been just one part of the story. In this, Margaret is judged rather oddly in the same fashion as her son, who still has a reputation as a rather mean, miserly man. He was nothing of the sort. He loved finery and jewels, and he understood very clearly the value of display, magnificence and entertainment. Many pageants and processions were given in his reign around public and dynastic occasions. Well, his mother was absolutely of the same mind. This is one of the highest status people in England, and she would have been failing in her responsibilities if she did not look the part, both in her clothing, in her jewellery, and in her estate. So the magnificence of her dress in the ceremonies of 1487 would not necessarily have been unusual. Her accounts bear witness to the size of her expenditure on clothes, as they do on her jewels. Many might have been a religious theme in line with her piety, such as a piece of the cross, for example. But that little bit of wood was set in gold, with pearls and precious stones. So it did both jobs, of piety and of magnificence. When she died, the plate and jewels in her possession were all totted up and amounted to over £4,000 worth, or close to £3 million quid in today's money. And finally, Margaret was a stickler for court ceremony and protocol. With energy and efficiency, she got properly stuck in and involved. She did not, repeat not, hang back and hide her light under a bushel. The ordinances of the royal household were revised in 1493, and it used to be thought that this was Margaret's work. The point's been made that there's no contemporary evidence that it was actually her that did it, but given Margaret's activity elsewhere, it seems likely she had some involvement. In 1503, after the death of Prince Arthur, the heir to the throne, it was Margaret who drew up detailed protocols for the funeral. The same applied to the journey of Princess Margaret to her bridegroom, James IV of Scotland. On occasion, you have to think that the presence of fingers in pies must have been a bit irritating. In 1501, in preparing for the marriage festivities of Arthur and Catherine of Aragon, Margaret prepared a list of Queen Elizabeth's household officers. Some of the names against jobs are left blank, ready to be filled in once Margaret had discussed them with her daughter-in-law. I think Elizabeth might well have felt either that she was perfectly capable of choosing her own officers, or, well, maybe she welcomed the advice. When Catherine of Aragon's household was put together, it contained several examples of overlap, where officers were working for both Catherine and Margaret. I mean, you know, helpful, or possibly creepily controlling. So where have we got to? Margaret was trusted and involved by her son in matters of policy and practicalities at court. Margaret was fully aware of her own status and her own worth, and was at pains to make sure everyone else knew it too. She was energetic and well organised. She knew she could make a practical difference, and so she did so. Almost everything she did, though, was oriented to making her family and son succeed. So, if you were Elizabeth, Queen, leading woman of the realm, you could very well find this irritating and intrusive. How do we think Elizabeth did feel about it? Well, firstly, the evidence for the prosecution. In 1498, the Spanish ambassador wrote a report back home about Henry's reign and security. This was a matter of major concern to the Catholic monarchs because they were considering whether or not to send their precious daughter Catherine of Aragon to England. And they really didn't want to land her in a fresh round of the Wars of the Roses. In the report back home, Ayala, the ambassador, had this to say about Elizabeth and her mother-in-law. He is much influenced by his mother and his followers in affairs of personal interest and in others. The Queen, as is generally the case, does not like it. In another report, he was even blunter, remarking that Elizabeth, she is kept in subjection by the mother of the king. The other little snippet we have is from one John Hoyk, who wrote that he had spoken with the Queen's Grace and should have spoken more with her, said Grace, had it not been for that strong whore, the Queen's mother. Which kind of suggests that, whether helpfully or not is a bit irrelevant, that Margaret was getting involved in Elizabeth's business and up her nose. Now, there are other interpretations possible of this evidence. One is that ambassadors are far from perfect commentators, being somewhat outsiders at court. And we don't know what John Hoyk was after, or his provenance. Maybe Margaret shared some crucial information that protected her daughter-in-law, and maybe that's why he was then cross. Elsewhere, there are signs that although Margaret was fully aware of her own status, she was not ignorant nor careless of the proprieties. So one famous example of this is that it was observed at one public ceremony that Margaret was once again with the King and Queen, but that she took care to walk a step behind them. She was aware of protocol, and she observed it. Other evidence points to collaboration between the two women. They both pleaded with Henry VII not to send the young Princess Margaret to Scotland for her marriage to James IV too early, fearing that James might consummate the marriage while the princess was too young. And hey, Margaret would know all about the dangers of that. They also wrote to the Spanish court together, asking that Catherine of Aragon learn French so they could talk with her when she arrived, and they jointly commissioned a book from printer William Caxton. It's been noted that Margaret was the originator of the very idea that Henry marry Elizabeth, though I don't take that as proof positive, since the reasons were no doubt practical and dynastic, not because Margaret had conceived a great passion to rescue Elizabeth. She was a tool of policy in those discussions. Finally, the evidence of friction is limited to those two examples I gave you. To the outside world, it appeared they were perfectly compatible. Thomas More, for example, wrote that they lived in peaceable accord. You would think that surely something else would have slipped out if they were in furious discontent and disagreement. Well, maybe. But again, maybe not. The early Tudor chroniclers were notorious toadies. It did not pay to diss your employers, and in that respect, Ayala had a far less incentive to lie and make things look good. It would seem to me that it would be entirely possible to be either driven up the wall by the oh-so-frequent and active presence of the mother-in-law, but equally, if you shared said mother-in-law's values and outlook, to be quite delighted at the extremely efficient, reliable and capable additional pair of hands. So it really depends a lot on Elizabeth's attitude. And the general impression of Elizabeth is one concerned with piety, with the health of the household. There remains a strong impression of gentleness, that she held her own court, of course, as queen, but it tended to be less politically oriented than Margaret's, although, as we've seen, she was perfectly capable of intervening when she thought it necessary. Historians generally appear to be very keen to clear Margaret of the mother-in-law from hell tag. I have to say, I'm pretty sure she'd have rattled my cage, but I'm not a 15th century royal, and so I am a poor judge. The evidence is very solid that Margaret was valued, trusted, active and capable. There's equally no evidence that Elizabeth of York was undervalued or prevented from carrying out her traditional role as queen. And the evidence that Margaret prevented Elizabeth from happily fulfilling her role is much thinner than that for their collaboration. So, maybe that's where we should leave it. Right, next week then. How does Margaret's new ruling dynasty cope with the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune?